And as we were going through the streets of Dallas, we came to a building with a big Hertz sign on it. And it said Texas School Book Depository. And I remember I had just finished saying, what in the world is a school book depository? And with that, the first shot was fired.
Remembering the tragic events of November 22, 1963 in Dallas, the day President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. That voice belongs to Malcolm Kilduff, former assistant press secretary to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. His job was to tell the world that the president was dead. Hi, I'm Ron Smith. For the next 30 minutes, Malcolm Kilduff will share memories of what happened on that day 16 years ago on A Look At.
This is A Look At, the program that focuses on all types of personalities and topics of interest.
Hello again, I'm Ron Smith. It doesn't seem like 16 years, or for that matter, the third year that we've had Malcolm Kilduff on our program to talk about November 22nd, 1963, and his role as assistant press secretary to President Kennedy, but it surely is nice to have him back again. Mac.
Nice to be back, Ron.
You know, I mentioned, I guess, your dubious claim to fame, but to let our listeners and viewers know more about you, you've accomplished so much. You've worked in the U.S. State Department. You were in TV in Las Vegas. Recently in public relations at Lee's Junior College. You're now working for the Lee-Owsley County Health Exchange. You've done all these things and had an illustrious career, but once again, you're noted just for this one incident. Do you resent that fact at all?
No, I don't. No, I can't resent it because I have to be enough of a realist to realize
that notwithstanding what other work that I might have done, and how much effort I might have put into it, that is a historical fact, and my role in it cannot be ignored. It is, I suppose, rather ironic that such a tragedy, such as an assassination of a United States president, would do that to an individual. But after a little bit of adjusting, you do get used to it.
Is November 22nd just another day to you? Have you gone through any mornings of November 22nd these past 16 years and awoken with a thought that maybe it was just a bad dream? Do you have any special feelings when you wake up?
No, not really that day more than any other. I suppose like any other tragedy, for instance, a death in a family. Maybe you, many of your listeners, have experienced days that are particularly notable due to a death or due to some other occurrence. You relive those days no matter really what the date is. And to say that I think of November 22nd, 1963, I doubt that a week would go by or more than a few days would go by that something would not cause me to think about it. So it's kind of like it's with you always.
In what terms do you think about it?
Well, in terms of not necessarily the assassination itself, but more in terms of what this country lost insofar as a person is concerned, and also the horrible tragedy and stigma that this country felt throughout the world. Because, after all, we have assassinated more of our leaders in our short 200 years of history than any government in the history of the world, which is a frightening thought. We think of ourselves as a peace-loving people, but yet we have actually assassinated more in a short 200 years than all the little banana republics in South America.
Now, we have so little time to talk, Mac, but we're going to try to get as much information in as possible. For those who haven't heard your side of the story, I guess we can recap very briefly that you were, in essence, the press secretary on that day. Pierre Salinger was out of the country, so you were responsible for preparing the Dallas trip?
That is correct.
What did that consist of?
Well, Pierre Salinger, as you said, was out of the country with the then Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, who was on an economic trip to Tokyo. With the president, there was always the press secretary and an assistant press secretary. Well, since I was the assistant press secretary and Salinger was out of the country, it fell to me to literally take care of the press corps that was traveling with the president on that trip. In other words, to be the middleman between the president and the press for the entire trip and all the duties that, you know, go in connection therewith.
Let's talk about events then. Take us very quickly through the sequence then from the morning and the ride past the Trade Center.
Well, let me go back just a little bit. It was only a few weeks before President Kennedy went to Dallas that Adlai Stevenson had been down in Dallas, and he'd been belted with rotten eggs. And some people did feel that it would not be too good for the president to go to Dallas. There was a political feeling that today would be described as that of the far right in Texas at that time, the forces of Barry Goldwater were very much in evidence in Texas. We saw a number of signs for Goldwater. So there was a swing to the political right going on in Texas at that time.
But there weren't any hostile signs.
No, there were no hostile signs other than the problem with Adlai Stevenson in October, where he had been hit with a rotten egg. But it was felt by President Kennedy that it was more important to shore up his political walls in Texas because of the 1964 election, which would be coming up the following year. So following the advice of his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, he undertook this swing through Texas, through San Antonio, Houston, and Fort Worth. And then we were to go to Dallas and El Paso with a stop off at the ranch, at Lyndon Johnson's ranch. And so this was the reason behind the trip. The reason behind the trip was to try to bring the political forces, and it was admittedly a political trip, back together again behind Lyndon Johnson, who was waging kind of an internecine war with a then-Senator Ralph Yarborough.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have in a nutshell why we were there. It was for domestic political purposes.
All right. Take us then through the motorcade.
Well, the day before, November 21, had ended us up in Fort Worth. And up to that point, we'd been to the Manned Spacecraft Center, and we had had a good day of travel on the 21st. And on the morning of the 22nd, the president went down and addressed a group in the Texas Hotel in Fort Worth. And we took off, and we were to fly over from Amon Carter Field to Love Field in Dallas, Amon Carter Field being in Fort Worth. So we went through a motorcade in Fort Worth, a good crowd reaction, and we flew over the very short distance of about 20 minutes into Love Field in Dallas. The reason we flew in there, it was best to have first of all, you had to get Air Force One over there, but it was better to move the press over there by plane because we had about 150 newsmen who were traveling with us on that trip. So while we were in the air, Air Force One spun around a couple of times so it could be in the air, and the press plane landed first, just took a short hop over, and the same newsmen that had waved goodbye to us at Fort Worth were there to wave hello to us 20 minutes later in Dallas. The motorcade formed up. There was a fair crowd at the Dallas airport, but that had not been ballyhooed as any sort of a airport arrival with any sort of the ceremonies at airports. It was just for the president to get into his car and take off to go to the Trade Mart. So there was not a very large crowd at the Dallas airport at Love Field. And what crowd there was a very friendly crowd. We did not spot any Goldwater signs. We did not spot any signs that were critical of the president's policies with respect to the Cuban Missile Crisis or anything of that sort. It was a friendly crowd. And here in the, really what we considered the seat of the far political right, being Dallas, Texas, instead we found the crowd friendly. As we formed up in the motorcade, I was in the third car. And as we drove down to the Trade Mart, we took a very circuitous route from Love Field to the Trade Mart. There was a shorter route, but politically, again, the decision was made to make a longer route and to swing around the city and to come up through the downtown area to give the crowd, and that would have been the noontime crowd, a better time to see the president and a better opportunity to see him. So that's precisely what we did. And those decisions were all made on a political base. Mm-hmm. They were not made by any secret group or anything of that sort. It was just a plain out-and-out political maneuver.
But the regular security precautions were taken.
The normal security precautions were taken. And as the motorcade proceeded, the crowd was good, as I said. And we came to the school book depository, and as I previously said, I looked up at the sign and I said, well, the name of God is the school book depository. And as we swung there on Elm Street, the first shot was fired. And my first thought was that this was around Thanksgiving. And fireworks are sold in Texas around Thanksgiving, as they are in a lot of Southwest areas. And then the second shot was fired. By that time, I had turned around and I was looking up in the window of the Texas School Book Depository, because being in the third car, the shots came directly over my right shoulder and above. And as we talk later, that will become more important. But I was turning around trying to see where the shots were coming from. By that time, the third shot had rung out, and we were starting to speed up, and the motorcade sped up. And we literally got out of there. But I could not see ahead, two cars ahead of me, to see what was going on in those cars.
How long was it between the time you heard the shots and when you realized what had really happened?
Not until we got to Parkland Hospital. See, the fact that shots had been fired was apparent. The police had drawn their weapons, but they could not return any fire because they couldn't see at that point where the shots were coming from. Because Dealey Plaza, where the event happened, is in sort of a bowl and has kind of a little rise on either side of it, and the shots echoed. You couldn't really get a good fix on where it was coming from. The only reason I had any sort of a fix on it is because, I looked over my right shoulder and above me. And that's why I've always been satisfied. I might say that is precisely where the shots came from, because I didn't do any sort of massive study at the time.
But other people have done massive studies, but you're reasonably sure those shots came from the building and only from the school.
Well, in answer to that, Ron, the only thing I can say is, if they had not, why did I look up there? In other words, I was not looking down the road 10 or 15 years hence when some character making $50,000 from a congressional committee was going to set up 15 microphones in an empty Dealey Plaza and shoot off a cap gun. Which is,
you sound bitter, are you?
No, I'm not bitter. I just think that a great number of these congressional investigations have been a farce, total farce. I don't think that they've really looked into it. They've spent over $500,000 looking into the various possibilities with no real reason behind it.
You never did believe in the conspiracy theory.
No, I never did. As a matter of fact, I think one of the reasons the assassination was successful was because it was not a conspiracy. It was the act of a single man acting alone who was not going to be betrayed by anyone. And that is why over these last 16 years, nothing has ever been proven or brought up that it was, in fact, a conspiracy. And I think the reason for that is because it was not a conspiracy.
Let's talk about the recent proposals by an English author to exhume the body of Lee Harvey Oswald, because he contends he was really a Soviet KGB agent posing as Lee Harvey Oswald. What are your feelings about that?
Well, I this fellow's written a book, hasn't he?
I don't know whether he's in the process or he has.
Yeah, I think he's writing a book, and I would say that he's doing some very good advance publicity on his book, much the same as many of these other people have done. Mark Lane, for instance. I'd like to have the money Mark Lane has made peddling his conspiracy theory without one single fact to back it up.
Do people want to believe there's a conspiracy then? How can you account for the success of these people?
I think that people are more comfortable believing there is a conspiracy. It's more exciting to the mind. And I think that it offends the American people and offends certain people to believe that just one person acting alone could kill the President of the United States. I think that they find that an offensive concept, and therefore they would much prefer to think, no, this is the clever work of a master conspirator. They would much prefer to throw it into the James Bond era.
They would hate to think that their president is so vulnerable.
That's right, exactly right, that he is that vulnerable. And John Kennedy was that vulnerable. Lyndon Johnson was that vulnerable. Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter, for the very simple reason that we live in a democracy. The President of the United States gets out among the people. He walks into a crowd. On his inauguration, how did Jimmy Carter get from the Capitol to the White House? He walked down Pennsylvania Avenue. How much more vulnerable could you do that in any other nation in the world, almost?
Now, Mac, people are listening to you criticizing these others for their conspiracy whatever theories, and maybe could be asking, well, if you feel this way, why haven't you written a book with the truth?
Well, because I do not feel that I have anything to say that has not been said. It's been said by the Warren Commission. I'm against the kiss-and-tell type books that have been written, first of all. Everybody and their brother has written a book, and to me it's blood money. In other words, Ron, on what basis would I sell the book other than the fact that I was the man who announced John Kennedy's death? Could I write a book saying that I am the man who glued pictures on passports in 1945 when I started out in the passport office? I don't think so. And to me, that's just blood money. And I don't like the kiss-and-tell books that some former associates of mine in the White House have written. I don't see any need for them. And I don't think that I have that much to add to that which has already been said.
If you've tuned in since we started the program, our guest is Malcolm Kilduff, Assistant Press Secretary, former Assistant Press Secretary to both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. Take us now to Parkland Hospital, because you do have some very important audio that we're going to hear in just a few minutes.
Well, when we first arrived at Parkland Hospital, as we drove in the motorcade, we passed the Trade Mart. Now, that is where we were headed in the first place. That's where the President was to speak, at the Trade Mart in Dallas. We went by there, and I said to our driver, who was an employee of the Southwest Bell Telephone Company, where could we be going? And he said, the only thing I could figure out is we're going to Parkland Hospital. Well, that's, of course, exactly where we went, and we pulled into the parking lot. I got out of the car and ran over to the President's car. I immediately saw what condition the President was in.
Did you think at that point he was dead because he...
No, it didn't, I figured, he's really been hurt. I mean, the concept of the President of the United States dead? Of course not. No, this isn't. This is America. That's not the first thing you thought. But it was obviously a mess, and he was badly hurt. So they brought a stretcher out, and we helped push the stretcher into the emergency room. Well, for whatever reason, my thoughts went back to the time when Eisenhower had his heart attack. And Jim Haggerty was Eisenhower's press secretary, and they were out in Denver. And they had to set up a press headquarters that lasted for weeks out in Denver, or Colorado Springs, I can't remember which, one of the two. And I thought, well, we're going to have to set up a press headquarters. So I told one of the men who was with me from the staff, Wayne Hawks, to go and find a room that we could make into a press room, get a hold of the telephone company, start pulling getting them to start pull telephone lines in there, because they were just the public telephone booths and the by the emergency room, because to me we would probably be there for a while. Mm-hmm. I then went into the what's known as the trauma room and was advised that the president was dead. I then went and discussed it with Lyndon Johnson. And that was always a very interesting aspect of it. I went up to, by that time they had gotten Lyndon Johnson into another room, another treatment room. But nobody had told him anything. And I walked into him to, after all, he was the president, de facto, if not yet sworn in. And I walked up to him, and I can remember very clearly thinking, what do I call him? I can't very well call him Lyndon. And Mr. Vice President was kind of awkward. And in point of fact, he was the president, so I called him Mr. President.
Did he know right then?
That's when he knew he was the president. Lady Bird kind of startled and kind of half screamed. And he came totally to grips with the situation. I said, I'm going to have to announce President Kennedy's death. And he said to me, he said, well, now, Mac, he said, I think we better wait a few minutes. He said, now keep in mind that I had said earlier that we were concerned about the far political right causing trouble. Lyndon Johnson's reaction was precisely the opposite. He said, now, let's just wait a minute, Mac. He said, we don't know whether this is a communist conspiracy or not. That was his first thought, which always interested me because our minds had all been going in the opposite direction. He said, I think I'd better get out of here, meaning the hospital, and back to Air Force One, and then you go ahead and make the announcement after I've left the hospital. And with that, we walked out, Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird, and I walked out of the hospital through the whole group of newsmen out to his car. Now, I know Bob Pierpoint of CBS, who was standing there, says he remembers seeing me walk out of the emergency room and has no recollection of having seen Johnson. And there is some footage still left around that does show me and Johnson walking out of the emergency room, but they all saw me, but they didn't see Johnson. So by that time, it was a little bit after 1 o'clock, and I fudged around enough time and then talked to the doctors in order to determine how I could, you know, what did the president die of, and at approximately what time did he die, and, you know, the details necessary for a press briefing. Also to find out what the condition of Governor Connally was. And so at 1:31, I got up on what was a little platform in the nurse's instruction room in Parkland Hospital, and made the announcement that John Kennedy was dead.
This is a piece of film and audio that we're going to have right now. How rare is this? Because I have never seen it anywhere before.
This film was shot by WFAA Dallas, which has changed hands in their archives, because I was down in Dallas a few years back, and that station does not have their own film, have this piece of film. To my knowledge, you and one other Kentucky television station are the only one that have the film. I do not know of anyone else who has it.
So this is a real rarity then?
Yes, it is, because I have it's been taken onto tape once into a second generation print, but not used any place other than by you, I believe.
All right, this is Malcolm Kilduff then with that announcement November 22nd, 1963.
John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died of gunshot wounds in the brain.
Slow it down.
I have no other details regarding the assassination of the president.
Anything about the shooting, the sniper?
No, we have no information on that.
Was Mrs. Kennedy here?
Mrs. Kennedy was not hit.
Was Connally hit?
Governor Connally was hit.
Was Vice President Johnson hit?
The Vice President was not hit.
No, was Connally hit?
Has the Vice President taken a role?
No.
Can we see him?
He has left.
Where did he go?
I'm sorry for
reasons of security, I cannot discuss the whereabouts or travel plans of the vice president.
What's Connally's condition?
I understand that Governor Connally's condition is satisfactory. He was shot twice, once apparently in the side, and once in the wrist. I'm sorry, Bob, I don't know.
You say it.
The president was shot once.
Where is Mrs.
In the head. Mrs. Kennedy will be returning to Washington.
Mac, in that event, and in the event of any unexpected presidential death, what preparations are made? Are any made beforehand, any consultation with the First Lady as to what will happen in the event of the death?
Not really with the First Lady. The surprising part about that is that within the military district of Washington at Fort Myer, Virginia, it used to be the 3rd Infantry, and I believe it still is, has down pat the order for a presidential funeral with the caisson and the horses and the whole business, which is precisely what was used then. So the protocol and order of things are set down literally in a manual in the State Department on what the diplomatic steps are to be, who is to be invited, how they're to be invited.
It seems rather cold, but
it's necessary. And within the military district of Washington, you've got the protocol of a presidential funeral. It's all laid out.
So little time left, Mac. A year ago, when you were on our program, you expressed a fervent hope that Teddy Kennedy would not run for president in the 1980 elections because of your fear that another murderer is out there somewhere waiting for this chance. Teddy's thrown his hat into the ring now.
Yeah. Aren't you glad that I didn't predict that he wouldn't run? No.
What are your intimate feelings, though?
Well, I feel precisely the same. After all, it was not just John Kennedy who was shot by an assassin, but Robert Kennedy was shot by an assassin. An attempt was made on Gerald Ford's life. It seems to be the habit of a few kooks in the country, and I suppose in a country of over 200 million people, you're going to have one or two kooks. And I just believe, and I'm fearful of the fact that Teddy Kennedy is going to become a victim of another one of those kooks who say, I'm going to join with Lee Harvey Oswald and Saran and go down in history. And I just, for that reason, I don't like to see him running. I think Rose Kennedy has been through enough. I think she's one of the most magnificent women I've ever seen in my life. She's been through it all.
But she is the one who gave her endorsement.
That's right. That's right, because she values public service above her own personal feelings.
Just very briefly, Mac, would you actively campaign for him if he were to ask you?
If he would ask me, I would.
Do you think there's a chance of that?
I have no way of knowing that. I would rather doubt it. I'm pretty well involved right now.
Mac, our 30 minutes is gone again. I really hate to say it,
especially
it does go fast. This time. Thank you very much for joining us again on A Look At.
Thank you, Rob.
Malcolm Kilduff, former Assistant Press Secretary to both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And I'm Ron Smith for A Look At.